So, big thanks to Kay and James and Rick and all the others of you from the, I think you're UTS Cosmopolitan Civil Societies. We're the parochial civil society center in South Africa, and actually we're actually a very uncivil society center because our environment, perhaps unlike yours, is one in which we have lots of uncivil people. There are friends, mainly the ones on the right, when they wear red, and they protest more than anywhere else in the world. Per person. I think China's still number one at about 85,000 measured protests by their police, but they have 1.4 billion people. We only have 50 million, so I think this is the highest rate. Well, maybe Iraq is higher, but this is social protests, not bombs on the side of the road. So it's a really amazing environment in which we're operating that pushes us way outside the normal limits of academia, so that we're trying to get a kind of praxis in which we're learning from wide-scale systematic protests against structural injustice. And since I had a wonderful time here as the center inaugurated in October, talking a little bit about climate change, there's a and also about the global justice movement debates. There's a piece from the Wednesday last week, the Nation, Red Plan Worse for Murray, just so we can connect the dots from what I was saying last October and then this weekend when Green Left Weekly had a wonderful conference on climate change and social change, and they brought me over, very grateful to them. The introduction of an emissions trading system by the Rudd government will leave the Murray River in worse shape than it is despite the so-called breakthrough water security agreement. Leading water scientist Mike Young says the state water contracts are going to leave potentially massive amounts of water sucked out of the system by forests planted along the Murray to soak up greenhouse gases, and the situation will worsen when the government introduces an emissions trading scheme in 2010. So that was what our concern was when I saw you last, and remains a big concern that a new market's emerging with all the financial speculation going on and bursting like bubbles all over the world for emissions trading to generate this brand new commodity, dare I call it, the privatization of the air. It's also going to affect, I think, your water in an adverse way. So we've had that experience with particularly the way the unsustainable city, probably the most unsustainable city in the world, I argue in a book called Evil Paradises that Mike Davis co-edited last year. I have a Johannesburg chapter, and we get our water when I live in Joburg, which was from 1990 until I moved to Durban in 2004, from Lesotho. So let's look at what that means and what it means for pricing and civil society protests, because the protests that you'll see and maybe got a bit of a sense of from that film of really angry people involved in kind of IMF riots where the water price goes off or disconnections hit, and then they reconnect in interesting ways. But now they're also going to court. And in December, the crucial point here, and I think I sent Rick and Kay a couple of new papers on this that reflect the legal battle going on. It's on a website from our colleagues at WITS University Center for Applied Legal Studies. And we have this really amazing case of 4,000 pages. Anybody want a PhD topic? There you are. There's your database. And it's really amazing because we're really fighting on two big fronts. Should we allow prepaid water meters, which I'll explain in a moment, and also what should the price of water be? So to get through about 125 slides in, no, not that many, but in 20 minutes, it'll just go really fast. And the bottom line is, this is the debate, commodified water or decommodified water. Now, where's the commodified? Well, commodified, I've lost it. Anyway, decommodification is really where we want to end up with progressive civil society, universal free lifeline, valorizing the public goods, the merit goods, the gender equity and public health multipliers, economic multipliers, environmental factors, desegregation that comes from having a good water supply that's publicly, not privately supplied, on a human rights model, and a luxury consumption tax for reasons you'll see very clearly associated with the hedonism of my fellow white petty bourgeois consumptive, over-consumptive households in the suburbs who use water for English gardens in the Highveld and swimming pools. And this is in a city with no natural water. Does that sound familiar to some of you in Sydney? Have you over-consumed a bit here too? So you've got legislative and constitutional protections for a right to water. So that's what we're aiming at. There's another slide about what the other team wants, which is commodification, which is especially the bottom line you'll see. Well, here it is indeed, The Economist. Pricing water according to market. The Economist's 2003 survey said that water's been ill-governed and colossally underpriced, so we've got to price water more sensibly. Although water's special, its provision and use will respond to market signals, and the best way of getting the water to poor people, treat water pretty much as a business like any other. So there's the very open, extreme market position. So water is just a commodity, and we know what that means, really. Any environmental good that goes to the market is subject to Larry Summers' endorsement, because he thought that the economic logic behind dumping a load of toxic waste in the lowest wage country was impeccable, and we should face up to that. He was the World Bank chief economist, and then the finance minister for Bill Clinton, and then president of Harvard, and he had the same perspective on women that he did on Africa. That is not high regard, and so he was fired by his faculty a couple years ago. It was quite a great breakthrough. I know you've got a great president here who introduced us, but if your presidents ever get out of control, just warn them about what Harvard did to their sexist and I think really racist president, who as World Bank chief economist was strategizing for how the bank could play a role in the Rio Earth Summit in 92. And as you know, even though that's an extreme statement he had to back down from, when the secret memo was released, it was published in full in The Economist magazine and endorsed by The Economist magazine. And he was embarrassed. And yet, although this was, in his words, ironic, he, I think, has put his finger on the logic of commoditization of the commons and of taking anything like toxic waste and imagining you can send it through and price it. And they have, in the World Bank, come back a little bit from that time and adopted more balanced, sustainable development rhetoric, noting that water is a scarce good, but has dimensions of not just economic efficiency, but social equity and environmental sustainability. And they had a whole World Development Report devoted to a sustainable development perspective that mixes the different discourses, and yet there is a good critique of what they're trying to do. In other words, they talk left on sustainable development, but the concrete processes, as we found when we hosted in Johannesburg the World Summit on Sustainable Development, is in fact full of PPPs, which maybe you know is public-private partnerships that are in fact euphemisms for privatization. We'd want to have some PPPs, I think, public-public partnerships where state agencies can help each other, especially municipalities that are under-resourced, getting support from catchment agencies. That's a standard process. And then public people partnership, where communities play a role with the state, and public proletarian partnerships, where the trade unions that work in these sectors can inform usually an unresponsive managerial bureaucratic class in the state. But instead, we get the other PPP. And that meant that in Johannesburg, we had a lot of reaction, about 30,000 people marching from this township, Alexandra, to the Sandton Convention Center, the richest suburb in the third world, Sandton, the new financial district. 30,000 saying to the United Nations, go home. You guys have done too much damage by introducing market logic into the debate about water. They called it the World Summit on Sustainable Development with dollar signs, and really had a range of critiques, including climate change not being on the agenda. Another story. The basic bottom line in World Bank practice, I think, is notions that the poor are willing to pay, have the capacity to pay. The problem has been that middle-class people get the water in African cities, and they're supplied water with repressed tariffs. The prices are too low. And indeed, as the bank says, we still need work with political leaders and some national governments, in South Africa, to move away from the concept of free water for all, and we need 100% recovery of operation and maintenance. That, I think, is the dogma, the religious bottom line commitment to not distorting the markets, to getting the prices right. And that means, for those of you knowing economics, microeconomics, as we'll see, it means covering your marginal cost, at least. The rest of the agenda continues. Big dams, the World Commission on Dams, that was partly sponsored by the bank, was in fact sabotaged by its staff, including a South African, and corruption and displacement, overspending and ecological damage in major dam projects continue. Somebody's here from the Mekong. Am I right about that? Yeah, lots of NGO critiques. Michelle Kamdasu, former head of the IMF, comes into the bank and into the World Water Forum in the Osaka meeting in 2003 with a new report saying these poor companies exposed in Argentina on their currency risk, big companies exposed in privatization contracts where there are protests, big companies involved in dams, they need risk insurance. Privatization conditionality continues in the highly indebted poor country, debt relief initiatives and other structural adjustment programs, and then, as I say, this marginal cost-based pricing. I'll show you the implications for Johannesburg in a moment. the development of these discourses of sustainable development, which really disguise a deep-rooted commitment to the commodification, begins with Rio in 92 and then Dublin, and then the World Water Forum sort of forming in the 1990s, finding in The Hague in 2000 the first resistance by Public Services International, a big trade union federation of public sector and especially municipal workers, and then 2002 at the WSSD, and then 2003 in the Kyoto Osaka World Water Forum. And the biggest protest, and I have a bit more discussion of that and the forces behind it, would have been 2006 in Mexico City at the World Water Forum, where 10,000 protesters came up to the water establishment in this World Water Council and World Water Forum and protested and set up their own forum. So like the World Social Forum coming up against Davos, this is moving along, and I'll give you their punchline in a moment. The private sector is in retreat from infrastructure. This retreat continues, but particularly the problem for water. This set of slides is from the Cam de Sceaux report, reflecting how little investment in the water sanitation sector. In turn, logically, the outcome of how low the rates of return are. You actually have a negative rate of return cost recovery of about 60% on every dollar you invest in water under the present circumstances, say compare that to telecom. So privatization has actually retreated, and the big UN reports, UNICEF and UNDP reports in 2006, really remark upon how a combination, both the internal difficulties, the logic of getting profits from water, and popular resistance together have meant a retreat from water. So the third discourse after neoliberalism, sustainable development, where civil society has begun an argument, in fact, at the global scale, just defeated a couple of weeks ago with the Council of Canadians and the Blue Planet Project arguing in the United Nations for this sort of phraseology. Mikhail Gorbachev and his Green Cross Project came instead with the right to water, but also the right to make profits from water. So they won, actually, because of the Canadians vetoing in the Human Rights Commission this kind of language. But this is where a lot of the movement people have found some respite. Unfortunately, living in South Africa since 1990, I can attest that there's a lot of this sort of rhetoric in our government and our ruling party, but it's meaningless and it's couched in all manner of sort of caveats, incremental, progressive realization of the rights according to how much available resources there are. So we haven't really won, although we're hoping this case filed in December may move things forward. Because this is partly about the green and the red linkage we're looking for in water, that is scarcity and sites of production of water on the one hand, often in rural areas, in this case up in the mountains, and we're looking for the consumption and demand side on the other, and finding an alignment between a kind of politics of urban and rural that's eco-feminist, that's red and green, that's technically competent but not reformist in a narrow sense. These are the sorts of things we're seeking, and it's really important that here we find the combination of a big dam, the biggest dams in Africa I'm going to show you, and the biggest company, water company in the world, or maybe second after Veolia, Suez, coming from Paris to run pretty much the biggest contract, certainly in Africa, in Johannesburg, for 5 years. And the water shortages is a real concrete problem in this area, and especially with climate change affecting the watersheds. It's not just a social construct. The temperature in southern Africa rising. And here we've got internal to Johannesburg a major problem of access that's come up since about 1994 when Alexandra Township, you saw where people were in those little huts there, marching to Sandton, and Sandton residents, very powerful, and big companies with big commercial property holdings not wanting to redistribute through higher rates and water bills to poor people in Soweto, and they actually lost their case in the courts. Meanwhile, the city itself is becoming a US-style, Australian-style, maybe set of edge cities with the deconcentration of business, as particularly white flight means a whole set of deconcentrated spaces with very hedonistic water consumption norms in sort of suburban business parks. And the decline of the center city, but the rise of this place, Sandton, is accompanied by the townships degenerating as sites of residents. And you can see the highly politicized character of water in civil society struggles. Destroy the meter, enjoy the water. I think I'm being taped, so I won't read any further. But then you see the sort of desperation of people going to dirty water. This is in the midst of the cholera outbreak, and so it's a highly politicized situation. And the low-income people express with very low human development index compared to high-income people, express great complaints and grievances about water. You can see about 42% say that water access is a problem in Johannesburg, the richest city. Business, you see at the bottom bar on the reliability of water supply, about 90% are satisfied or think it's fair or excellent. And that's because they've got the access to this water coming in now since 1998 when the dam was finally finished, the big Katse Dam, and secondly the Mahale Dam you can see there being constructed. And you see the pipe between Mahale and Katse. These are pipes that then lead through about 45 kilometers of mountain, the biggest cross catchment transfer in Africa, and bring us into the river that feeds the Johannesburg area. Johannesburg, where we found gold in 1867, has no water of its own, but pumps it up from that river, the Vaal River, about 70 km. And that's the some shots of the dam and the dam site. Basutu peasants with very little arable land there. And the biggest dam in Africa, the Katse, 185 meters, the Mahale under construction. It's the highest profile case in the third world of corruption, and the World Bank actually has debarred a bunch of major companies after initially refusing, and under a lot of pressure did. There was a controversy over its construction and financing in the 1980s because it was an apartheid sanctions buster, and ecological damage, displacement, resettlement problems, the geopolitics associated with that invasion that the film showed in 1998 was associated with a fear by the South African National Defence Force that the Basutu soldiers who were involved in a rumoured coup might blow up the dam and threaten Joburg's water supply. So they went in and shot 29 sleeping soldiers that night, helicoptering up in the city of Maseru. The next day burned to the ground while the South African soldiers secured the dam. Very tragic. The dam costs a lot more than the existing water supply, a factor of 5 times more, about 1.50 rand, or about it's about 20 Australian cents per kiloliter. And instead of paying that high amount, the argument we were making in civil society was to have a much faster rising tariff to penalize the overconsumption, to fix the leaks in the system where about 40% of the water leaks out before getting to taps, and to get water restrictions, and to really rethink whether Joburg, with no more mining activity, really should still be the primate city in terms of industrial activity and service sector activity. There was also a political factor as the ANC began to lose power and as the popularity and as the protest wave I've mentioned began in the late 1990s. And in the 2000 municipal election, there's a wonderful promise for free basic water. All residents get a free basic amount of water. I mean, that's me too. I'm a petty bourgeois and I get some free water. Isn't that remarkable? And I think that's good, and I'll tell you why. And that means you get free water so as to help the poor. Those who use more than the basic amounts, and I do after about 5 minutes in my day, I flush and I turn on the shower and there's my basic amount used, then I should pay extra. And the question is then how much and how is that being managed? It's a universal entitlement, so it's not means tested. It's not kind of thing where if you sell tomatoes, you have to go and show an employer slip to prove that you're indigent, although that now is a system just announced a couple of weeks ago they will move to because they realize that this is actually quite a powerful political weapon. It unites poor people, working people, middle class people in support of this entitlement. And it also means for conservation purposes that if we can price very high, we can possibly get, if the marginal price elasticity helps us, we can get the high-income folks to consume less. And that's the economics of the argument, that we are basically looking at this promise representing the rising block tariff, that's C. So you start at zero price, right down on the bottom left, and you move to your first block and you move up and you see at some point you cross the curve at which the cost of water meets the price of water, and at that point you're pricing high for high volume consumption. You're penalizing your over-consumptive hedonistic consumers and you're getting a surplus that can be used to cross-subsidize. Why is that? That's decommodification. Why is that under threat? I mean, A is the curve that the World Bank promotes, which is to get the prices right and to have your price equal to your marginal cost. Remember I said operating and maintenance. That's what the market needs to cover. If you're selling anything, you have to cover your ongoing costs. B is if you want to privatize and attract a private supplier, give that supplier a profit incentive, usually about 30%. Make sure it's on every drop. Because that way you don't distort the prices and you don't send mixed signals and you get the prices right. And so that's our basic contestation in microeconomic theory between commodification A, privatization B, and decommodification C. Is that fairly clear? So then we have to say, well, what happened in Joburg and why is it that us smarty pants academics say this is what we need to do and the activists come back soon after and tell us, hey, you guys really led us astray. Because what really happened is huge pressures, even though the ANC promised C, huge pressures not to. Here's the World Bank's very wording to Minister Osmal. I was an advisor to Minister Osmal, but I had no power, and these guys had all the power. And they said, don't do free basic water. It may limit options with respect to these municipal tertiary providers. Private concessions will be much harder to establish. Let's go back. You see why. Would you want to sell water in Johannesburg to people if you have to give it away for free? In other words, C would disincentivize Suez coming in. Well, Suez came in after the promise was made. What Suez would want, what the World Bank recommended, was to cut people's water if they can't afford to pay. The South African government needs a credible threat of cutting service. This advice was indeed taken, even though the World Bank didn't give a damn about the public health, gender equity, environmental, economic desegregation, even though the private investors have no interest in those because it doesn't bring in profits and dividend streams. Instead, the state and the society have an interest. But these don't get factored in when the World Bank gives advice of that sort. Other big factors in this debate, natural monopoly, lumpy investments, difficulty of regulation, corruption in the sector. Let's leave those behind. Now, the World Bank unfortunately did, I'm just jumping ahead by mistake, such a good job that they declared that their market-related pricing advice was instrumental in facilitating a radical revision during the late 1990s. And residually, that did have a role in places like Johannesburg, where they called for an enabling business environment for private sector investment through fiscal decentralization, i.e. a fragmented municipality, tariffs and for water and for electricity and rates kept low for businesses and rich people so you could attract them in, even though that led to wasteful water consumption. This strategy of privatizing, commodifying, privatization itself worked only in five areas, but then it broke down. And I won't go through all the details, just so we have a little bit more time for the sort of punchline argument here, which is that in Joburg, the price of the Lesotho water enhancements was paid by the poor, whose block one tariff rose by 39% during the late 1990s, while those who were consuming high amounts only rose 24%. It's a World Bank slide. So a lot of pressure in any kind of local situation by a growth coalition, big business, rich folks, and to keep their prices low, central local government shrinkage of subsidies and pressure to privatize. So Johannesburg's overconsumptive water consumers, especially the high-income residences and the businesses, didn't really notice the increase in prices. And poor people did, and they faced disconnections. In fact, about 1.5 million people are affected by disconnections of water every year because of their inability to pay, according to even the government. And this is what it looks like in terms of that price. This is the trick they played, which is why the community people came to us and said, hey, Patrick and our little team of researchers, you guys are completely wrong. Look, you told us our problems would be solved if we get this free basic water. And look at the trick. You can give a little bit of free basic water, but the second block of water goes way, way up. So after a small token amount, 6,000 liters per household per month, it soars to really high levels in a convex tariff curve. And of course, when they measure it by household, not by person, and you're looking at large, low-income households, backyard shack dwellers, grannies looking after a dozen kids because of AIDS orphans, well, we're seeing a real scrimping on water consumption. The activists said, no, we'd rather have much larger free basic water and then a more concave curve to get rich people to hit very high prices, and hopefully they would bring back their consumption. We wouldn't need prepaid meters, the Lesotho dams. Very quickly, three techniques of Suez. They didn't want to give water to poor people. They gave a 6,000 liter token amount. How do you stop people consuming after that? Three quick techniques. Foucauldians here, right? Foucauldians, what do you call yourselves? You will be interested because the biopolitics of water in Joburg is probably most advanced. Prepaid meters, and I gather Aboriginal people are also being subject to the prepaid meter technology in Australia. And it's a self-disconnection technique where you only get a little bit in your first card and then it runs out and then you have to pay quite high amounts. And those are being hotly contested. I'll show you a picture of a prepaid meter being torn out, and they're declared illegal in Britain as a public health threat. And that's one of the key things in the court case I mentioned. Secondly, the pit latrine, going back sort of to 19th century sanitation technologies, although it's ventilated improved for very impoverished people, but these are being put into the Johannesburg water system, even though the ground is dolomitic, it's a mining area, and the excrement goes right into the water table, and so rich people kind of find a little bit of a blowback as E. coli seeps into their boreholes, and they have to empty their swimming pools in panics and things. So this was going on during the cholera epidemic. And so lots about the VIPs. This is the most bizarre. It's something called a shallow sewer, which is a very thin pipe that's not dug very deep. And you can see from Johannesburg water, which is really Suez, giving a 12-point kind of plan to, you know, instruction booklet in English to low-income, of course it's women who are going to be doing this, about what you do when your meter clogs up. Because the pipe does not clog up by accident. It clogs up by design so that the company can save money and not give the consumer much water. So you open the inspection chamber, you wear gloves, you remove the solids and waste, do a mirror test. If waste material is found in a section, bring in a tube, and until it comes into contact with the obstruction, with shit, right, that's clogged up, block off the outlet from the downstream inspection chamber with the screen that allows water to pass through. Push the tube until the material is moved to the downstream inspection chamber, wear gloves, and remove the shit by hand. Pour a large quantity of water through the section between the two inspection chambers and check for cleaning. Repeat the mirror test, close the inspection chambers. Inspection chambers must be kept closed at all times except during cleaning. So there's your instructions if you're a low-income, often illiterate woman, and now you're asked to do the work, really, of a water company, which is to put your hands in, because they don't want to build big enough water pipes and dig deep enough. So this is a money-saving device, again, to limit the water consumption. And of course, it blows back with huge protests coming on all the time and going to the courts now. And it's one of the most famous of the sites, with Cochabamba, with Argentine cities, with Accra, Ghana, and Manila. And I won't go into the Durban, but it's the same kind of argument. And this is the prepaid meter being torn out. I think this is the case of electricity, actually, but same concept and same movements. And they're notorious around the world for a self-reconnection, a bypass strategy that inspires all the autonomous friends I have. But what their socialist constitution, in this case the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee, declares is they really want policy changes, and they want proto-socialist strategies built into the municipal supply. And this is part and parcel of a broad campaign by numerous groups, often in conflict with each other, for land antiretroviral medicines. That's the most successful, where they've won free antiretrovirals, locally produced generically, instead of the $20,000 a year variety produced in New Jersey or Switzerland, branded and patented, that were only available. And so decommodifying those, free water and electricity and education and renationalization of telephones and prohibition on service disconnection, basic income grant, the right to a job, they're all struggles for universal human rights by civil society, interlocking, overlapping. I'm not saying all the 10,000 protests a year are in support of these. Many of them are incoherent or just come up because of some grievance or other. But there is this attempt to pull together through the South African Water Caucus and the South African Coalition Against Water Privatization a broader approach to human rights, to water management that's accountable, to maintaining river ecosystems and rejecting the commodification, and hence rejecting the USA and the other G8 countries and transnational corporations and the UN World Summit on Sustainable Development and the New Partnership for Africa. They reject lots of things. Well, what they're for, though, and like the People's World Water Forum, rejecting the World Bank, the IMF, the regional banks, and the major water companies, Vivendi, Suez, Bechtel, and the World Water Council. There you see Maud Barlow, Vandana Shiva, amongst others of the notables in the sector. Water's a human right, and corporations have no business profiting from people's needs. And the People's World Water Forum putting forth an alternative vision, building a massive network of water warriors, an anti-privatization movement, and in fact, I would say, exaggerations as there may be in lots of civil society rhetoric, they've actually done pretty much this. They've actually pushed back the water privatizer. So it's one of these areas. Hopefully they start linking with the health people, the treatment action people, and the electricity people, and the women's movement, and they come to the World Social Forum, and instead of going into their own little silos and, you know, relating to each other all the time, as they tend to do. We saw that in Nairobi last year. They'll start spreading out and linking with other transnational civil society networks. So I hope that's inspiring, because it is for me. Thanks.